It's a very great honour to welcome Dr. Steve Smith from the FSL group at the University of Oxford in England. As you know, Steve and his group have developed one of the most widely used toolkits in brain imaging called FSL. And I think really the breadth and depth of those approaches have really been a profound influence on brain imaging, not just in the field of DTI, but also in functional imaging and tracking brain structural change as well. So we're very honoured to have Steve here today. I think he's going to talk about one approach, tract-based spatial statistics, that's becoming very widely used and is very interesting for our analysis of DTI. So thanks, Steve, for coming. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Thank you, Paul. Thanks very much for inviting me. Does this sound okay at the back? It's a bit echoey. So this is very different flavour from the previous talks. I'm not going to talk much about tractography at all. I'm going to talk about a very complementary kind of analysis that people generally want to do as well as tractography, or in some cases before tractography. I'm going to talk about various methods of doing voxel-wise statistics on diffusion data, but I'm going to mostly talk about the method that we've developed, because that's obviously one that I'm most familiar with. So whereas tractography is all about, for example, seeding one point in the brain and seeing where does that connect to, according to the diffusion data, another question that people regularly want to ask with diffusion data is if they've acquired diffusion data on multiple subjects, for example, a group of controls and a group of patients, they want to analyse the entire brain and say, according to the diffusion data, where is one group different from another? Typically, most commonly, people feed in fractional anisotropy images. So, to re-summarise what the previous speakers have explained on this, if you have a circular diffusion tensor so that you've got just perfectly isotropic diffusion, there's basically no tract information, then FA is zero. As you get more and more anisotropic, FA heads up to one, and one would tell you that, for example, you're in the centre of a very strong, thick tract where there's only really diffusion going in one direction and not at all in the others. So it turns out that FA, the strength of FA from 0 to 1, encodes how strongly directional the diffusion is and is a really good marker for white matter integrity generally. For example, reflects things like the state of myelination and the general integrity health of the white matter cells, and therefore is a good marker for disease development. And so typically people want to do voxel-wise statistics on FA images to see where different subjects are different from each other. There are other tensor-derived parameters such as the mean diffusivity or just the overall volume or size of the tensor, so that's just the average of the three tensor eigenvalues. And then there's also another thing which people in C.F. Weston's group have come up with. Gordon Kindleman has suggested this thing called the mode. You can see that here in this plot where FA is increasing up to down, and then left to right, the mode is changing from 1 to minus 1, depending on basically whether we've got one strong tubular fibre or a more planar tensor, which would be typically if you have two strong crossing fibres. And so mode is another independent piece of information, say, from the FA and the MD. And so you might want to test all three of these for changes across subjects. So an obvious thing that people thought that they would do with FA data to take this kind of approach to look at voxel-wise changes across subjects was simply to feed it into a VBM style analysis. I'll try and be somewhat polite because John is actually sitting in the audience here. The top half is a simple re-summary of the traditional VBM style analysis that was originally developed and still mostly used for T1 weighted structural data, not diffusion. So few seconds, the first step is to take all of the subject's data and align them into standard space and to get them segmented into different tissue types. And this is typically done with the SPM software. And so typically you just take the gray matter binary segmentation, you smooth it for various practical and theoretical reasons, and then you do voxel-wise statistics. So at each point in standard space, for example in the MNI-152 standard space, you take that voxel at that point of interest and compare that across all the subjects with GLM. And you do that at every voxel, and you look to see where one group is different from the other. For example, you've got a blob here that's different from one group from the other statistically. It's actually even easier to do this on diffusion data, say on FA data, because you don't need the segmentation step. You just get all of the FA images aligned, and you get that you can then smooth and then go straight to the voxel-wise statistics on the FA. And you've got examples here of where people have found differences. So the strengths, it's fully automated, it's quick, it's very easy to investigate the entire brain. You don't have to pre-specify where you're going to look. And for example, you might find a blob and then go and look at that blob in more detail with other analysis, for example, tractography. But the problems are quite severe. These problems, particularly with respect to alignment issues, have been discussed in the context of traditional VBM and structural data, but they're actually a lot more severe on FA data, on diffusion data generally. And the problem is, generally, that you have, after the nonlinear registration that takes all of the subjects, hopefully into alignment with each other in standard space, you'll always potentially have a little bit of residual error. Now, the problem with FA is that the tiniest amount of perpendicular error, so perpendicular to the, say, the edge of a tract, is potentially going to give you a very, very sharp change in FA because the tracts are thin. So the tiniest misalignment in the tract is going to potentially get misinterpreted as a change in FA. So we've actually got examples here where I'm quite suspicious of the results that were presented. This was presented at ISMRM, and I think it's pretty clear what's going on. So they're claiming that one group of subjects has higher FA here, and the other group has higher FA here. And actually all that's happened is that the corticospinal tract has slightly shifted in one group relative to the other, probably because of larger ventricles maybe, and that the nonlinear registration has not been able to fully remove that difference. This was actually published in, I think, Nature Neuroscience. Again, I'm very suspicious because the claimed blob is right on the edge of the tract, and again, it's more, I'm suspicious that it's a slight shift, either a shift in the tract or a change in the tract thickness, but this has been interpreted as a change in FA. If it was a change in FA, you'd expect more to see it, you know, in the center of the tract there. Another approach, which isn't really solving the original problem, is to hand place voxels or regions of interest by hand on every subject. And you would hope that if you choose simple areas to do that, you can get good correspondence between subjects. But of course, you're not investigating the whole brain. It's subjective. It's potentially inaccurate, depending on which structure you're aiming for. And so there's been a few cases where people have tried to solve the correspondence problem or the registration problem through the use of tractography. For example, these references here. So this is Gong's work. Basically, they identified the upper cingulum bundle using tractography. I think they placed by hand seeds at the beginning and end, ran tractography, and then they've identified the left and right upper cingulum bundle, and then they parameterized the FA along the cingulum bundle. So you have FA as a function of angle. And if you do that for every subject, you can then compare that across the subjects, and you no longer have to do any registration. You've already solved the correspondence problem with another method. So here we've got, for example, a single subject, the left and the right cingulum bundle, FA as a function of angle. And you can then directly compare that across subjects and do a t-test at every angle between the groups of subjects. But of course, it hasn't fully solved the original problem which we wanted to solve with these methods, which is we didn't really want to have to specify which part of the brain we were going to look at and have to go in by hand and get involved that way. We wanted to be able to automatically test the whole brain. More sophisticated, more recent approaches, which actually has quite a lot of similarities to our work, which I'll present next, is also tractography based, but tests more of the brain in a more automated way. And this is really nice work from Jim G, who's going to talk later in the week. So in this case, you take the tensor images from each subject, and you warp them into a standard space so that hopefully they're all reasonably well aligned. You then average all of the subjects together, so you have an average tensor map in standard space, and run tractography in that space, and then do some clustering and identify the six major fasciculi in that standard space. And these are now represented rather than as the individual streamlines, because they've been clustered, it's now effectively represented as volumes, which are slightly thickened, because obviously you've got lots of streamlines which occupy three dimensions. So these different standard space average fasciculi are then represented as medial surfaces. So effectively you can think of the central thin surface or skeleton running through these volumes, and I'll come back to that later because it's a similar idea to what we've used. And so once you've got the medial surface representations for all of these major fasciculi, you project the data for each subject onto that medial surface so you can then compare across subjects. The primary method they use is to take the mean diffusivity and to average it across the width of the fasciculi medial surface. So perpendicular to where I'm pointing there, it will just average across the thin volume. And then you can do the cross-subject statistics. And that's what you're seeing here in red is regions of significant difference between the groups. So now I'll describe in detail the approach which we published 2 or 3 years ago, tract-based spatial statistics. And what we wanted to do was to basically solve this issue of the residual alignment error after the initial nonlinear registration. And in brief, what we do is try and solve that by only working in the centres of all of the tracks. That's what you can see in bright here is what we're calling the track skeleton. This is also what you can see here in the 3D rendering is the track skeleton. So what do? We start by aligning all of the subjects' FA data together. So effectively, the first stage is similar to a VPM style analysis. We use fairly high dimensional, quite fast nonlinear registration, FNIRT, and this is the result of that. And you can see we've got good alignment in the major central parts of the brain, and then the more cortical you get, the more peripheral, there's so much variability in the thinnest tracts across subjects that you're not getting perfect alignment there. And you don't actually want to try and push the nonlinear registration to go to such high degrees of freedom, though you could, that you get everything aligned, because you'd start to break things, you'd start to break topology. And on the bottom here, you can just see the improvement from affine to nonlinear with six different subjects, corpus callosum, relative to the standard space template. So the next step is to take all of these initially aligned data sets and average them. And so this is the group mean from all the subjects in the study, the group mean FA in standard space. And now we're going to skeletonize that, and so we're going to try and find the centers of all of the major tracts that we see on this average image. It turns out actually that most of the tracts in this kind of image, in an FA image, look much more like curved surfaces than tubes. So for example, the lower cingulum bundle does look tubular, but almost everything else, when you look locally, looks more like a curved surface rather than a curved line. So most of the skeleton is actually a one voxel thick curved line. So we take the mean FA image and just apply very simple image processing morphology operations to thin it down to this thinned surface, the skeleton. So this is the unthresholded skeleton shown in red to yellow. And we're going to threshold that at, for example, So it has FA values in it of, as I said, 0 to 1. We're going to threshold it at, say, 0.2 or 0.3 for a couple of reasons. One is that as we get closer towards the periphery of the cortex, we're moving into grey matter. We're no longer even in white matter. So if the average FA value across all subjects is that low, we clearly are not going to be claiming that we're in white matter anymore. The other thing is that, again, towards the periphery, the nonlinear registration is not succeeding in getting all the tiniest, more variable tracks aligned. And again, by thresholding the FA at, say, 0.2, we're identifying those parts of the skeletons which we believe we can reliably compare across subjects. And so this is a 3D rendering. If anyone's good at cross-eyed stereo fusion, you've got 3 seconds to achieve it. Put your hand up if you've achieved it. Oh, he's quick. Okay, if you look, say, top right here, the red skeleton is the same in all cases, and the underlying black-white images are different subjects, different sections of different subjects, FA images after the initial alignment. And you can see that the general correspondence between individual subjects' tracks and the skeleton is good, but certainly the alignment is not perfect. There's little alignments of 2 or 3 voxels, maybe misalignments. And if we were just to do voxel-wise statistics on the results of that initial alignment, we'd get the kind of problems that I was talking about earlier. So this is the residual misalignment which we're going to try and fix with the final stage of the TBSS preprocessing. So what we do for every subject, we take the skeleton, so the skeleton is the same for all subjects, we overlay that on each subject's data, and then we just search out from the skeleton, for each point on the skeleton, we search out perpendicular to the local skeleton until we find in the locality the maximum FA value. And therefore, we're defining that as being the center of the tract. So we're going to find the center of the nearest tract that corresponds to the skeleton, just take the value from that point and just place that onto the skeleton. So we're filling up the skeleton with the values from the tract centers, and we do that separately for each subject. And there's various rules that condition this search. For example, we only search halfway from one part of the skeleton to the next part. So there's no grabbing of data twice onto two bits of the skeleton. There's also a smooth Gaussian downweighting of how far it can go, again, to control, so it doesn't go wild in its search. And here's some examples on real data with 6 different subjects in the search from the same skeleton. So now we've done all the pre-processing and we're ready to do voxel-wise statistics. So this is just on the skeleton, everything else is gone. We've just filled up the skeleton with the track center data, and for each point on the skeleton, we can compare across subjects. So we've got 5 points here which we can feed into a general linear model. So typical GLM style, you might do a 2-group t-test, or you might model out the group mean and look at some covariate with, for example, age. The question is, how is this different from finding the skeleton initially in each subject? It's mostly just a question of practicalities. It's not a conceptual difference. It just turns out that it's a lot more robust and less noisy to take the average FA and create the skeleton from that, whereas if you take the skeleton and individual subjects, it's going to be a lot more noisy, but also, more importantly, it's not going to have correspondence between all of the subjects. So you could still do alignment things, but you wouldn't actually have one space which is your fixed constant, which is our mean skeleton. So we do that. We apply the GLM voxel-wise, and then on the skeleton we identify regions where you have statistical significance. So for example, here one group has significantly higher FA than the other group, and vice versa here. We strongly recommend only using permutation testing to do the inference. There are so many non-linearities, if you like, in all of the pre-processing that simple methods of inference, such as Gaussian random field theory, would just be broken. Their assumptions would not hold. Whereas permutation testing for this kind of thing is perfectly valid. It will give you perfectly valid inference, including correction for multiple comparisons across all the skeleton voxels. And a final tweak on that is that we've recently developed a new method for defining clusters. So traditionally, you might expect to do cluster-based thresholding. So in this controls versus schizophrenia example, we did cluster-based thresholding where you threshold your rule T statistic map at some arbitrary level and then test the resulting clusters that you form in that way for size. So you test whether their size is significant. And that might be done with Gaussian random field theory or permutation testing or whatever. But the problem is that it's completely dependent on the arbitrariness of this initial thresholding. The good thing about cluster-based thresholding is that it takes into account the spatial extent of the signal. So it's a little more sensitive, typically, than voxel-based thresholding. So it has some advantages, but it has some real disadvantages. Although I don't have time to go into it now, we've tried to improve that with a new method that's just coming out and being published now called threshold-free cluster enhancement, which enhances cluster-like nature without having to do this initial thresholding. And this is a particularly extreme example where it's showing hugely more sensitivity than cluster-based thresholding. Yeah?
I have a question. So the information at each voxel on the skeleton that you use, that represents a region or a neighborhood of this skeleton, is it?
You mean after applying TFCE?
Yeah, because you do the skeletonization, but on the previous slide you had somehow the more volumetric representation that was associated. No, it's in between. Sorry.
Yes.
You had some green. So each voxel on the skeleton, does it represent somehow like a cross-section or the...
Okay, yeah. Okay, so nothing to do with thresholding. So the question is, does each point in the skeleton, is that really a voxel-wise measure, or is it representing some region?
Yeah, because my question was, what kind of statistics to do and what? So is it a single value, or take the whole distribution associated with each voxel, and then do statistics on distributions of that data?
Okay. The question is relating to what local information is actually contained at any point. Actually, it does not represent a region, because what we do when we fill up the skeleton with values, for each subject, we only take the center of the local tract. So for that subject, that skeleton point has only come from one point, which is the closest tract center position. Now, it would be perfectly possible to integrate across the tract and pull in other information, which is the kind of thing that we're looking at. But generally what you do is just take the value from the track center. Okay, so anyway, this is our recommended approach for the thresholding. So now a few examples. So this was really nice work that Heidi Johansenberg did in collaboration with MNI. She just took healthy controls, just ran simple diffusion imaging on them, and then assessed their bimanual coordination ability, just some kind of finger task, and she just measured their ability. And she put that in as the cross-subject covariate, the model, in the TBSS analysis. And she found nice strong correlation in just a few areas, particularly right here, up in areas, motor tract areas. And then just to confirm that, she used that blob to seed tractography in each subject, and averaged across subject, that's what you see here, confirming very clearly that she was actually seeing bits of the motor network, the white matter motor network, correlating with the behavioural ability. But most commonly, this kind of approach is used for investigating pathology. So in this case, we had, I think it was about 30 schizophrenia patients and 30 controls. If you look at the group averages, which you don't actually do as part of the analysis, but it's informative, you can see larger ventricles in the schizophrenics, which has resulted in the upper surface here of the thalamus being pushed down. And so, not surprisingly, when you do the voxel-wise VBM-style analysis, you get a very strong false positive there, because you've got higher FA in the controls than the schizophrenics, because you're moving from thalamus into water. So that's very much a false positive, as well as seeing results in the fornix and the corpus callosum. TBSS gives similar results in the corpus callosum and the fornix, but it doesn't even recognize that there's a tract on the boundary between the thalamus and the ventricles, which there isn't. So it's nowhere near finding a false positive there. This is another example, multiple sclerosis. In yellow, we're looking at the correlation between the skeletonized FA and the disability score. And more interestingly, in red, we're looking at the correlation with each subject's lesion volume. So the cross-subject covariate is each subject's total lesion volume. The average across the group is shown in blue. The lesions were identified not from the diffusion data, but from other imaging. What you can see, interestingly, is that you'd expect to see a strong correlation between lesion volume and FA within the lesion areas, but we can also see a very strong correlation in normal appearing matter in the center of the corpus callosum there, where we don't typically see lesions. So it's obviously a very sensitive marker of what's going on, i.e. that the FA is. We took that further then, and we wanted to break down and understand better where this change in FA was coming from. So we're actually seeing three different analyses here, where we, on the left, where we correlated with the cross-sectional area of the corpus callosum, the lesion volume, and the disability score. But there's no reason, as I said at the beginning, why we have to only use FA. We can also feed in other diffusion tensor-derived measures, such as longitudinal eigenvalue lambda 1, which tells you about diffusion along the tract, and that's what we see here. And you can feed in the average of lambda 2 and lambda 3, which is telling you about diffusion perpendicular to the tracts. And so to do that in TBS is trivial. You just take the warp fields from the nonlinear registration and the skeleton projection vectors that you derive from the FA analysis, and you just apply the same warps and the same projections to any other native space diffusion-derived measure, such as the eigenvalues. And that's what we've done here. And what you can see is that there isn't much going on with the longitudinal diffusion, and there's quite a lot going on with the radial diffusion. And what that's telling us is that the apparent change that we're seeing in the pathology in FA is almost entirely caused by a change in the diffusion perpendicular to the tract. So, if you like, the water's leaking out of the tracts in the pathology. Final example is, here's a nice example of combining diffusion data with structural data. So in a VBM cell analysis of the structural data, Gwen Duo found changes in SMA and other interesting areas in schizophrenia. And when she ran TBSS on the diffusion data, it was a really nice confirmatory result that you've got the motor tract feeding up into the SMA. It's a very strong correspondence there. This isn't the last slide. So overall, we've tried to resolve the correspondence problems, and we've tried to come up with a method which has less ambiguity of interpretation as a simple voxelwise analysis, but it's still very sensitive to finding changes anywhere in the brain, and we can easily test the whole brain. There are obviously still issues about partial volume. For example, in the thinnest tracts, FA is still a result of partial voluming, so FA will be a combination of the tract thickness and the true FA, and that's what the few slides I'll come onto are about. Obviously, crossing tracts is also an issue that needs to be kept in mind when interpreting the results. It's possible for FA to go down, but that's actually because a secondary tract has got stronger, and so that kind of thing needs to be kept in mind. Okay, the final point is kind of exciting, and that's something we're putting a lot of work into now, which is that there is no reason why the final statistics that I was talking about need to be voxelwise. They can be multivariate, whether it's model-based or, say, model-free with an ICA-style approach. So I've got a few slides now just on more recent work where we've started to understand a bit more about the underlying partial volume issues. This is really nice ex vivo data at 0.7 millimeters on whole brain taken in Oxford by Carla Miller and Jen McNabb. This took about 4 days to acquire, the guy was dead. Yeah,
by the time
we were done. He was fine at the beginning. One interesting thing, which isn't relevant to the talk, but it's interesting, is you see this dark band. That's actually in the grey matter. So the grey matter-white matter boundary, we're pretty convinced, is the boundary between the dark and the white there. So this is white matter. And the dark band and the light band here are all grey matter. So this dark band is kind of interesting. A couple of people have seen it before, like Alex de Crespigny, but we're not quite sure what that is. Anyway, forget about that. It's not relevant. What is interesting is that when we smoothed the original raw data and then reran the tensor fitting, so effectively simulating what you would get in normal resolution, either 2 millimeters or 3.5, you see what you would get in normal data, and you can see that you get real tract thinning. So we need to keep in mind when interpreting diffusion data that what we think we're seeing is actually, particularly in these slightly thinner tracts, it's a lot thinner than what the reality, and the reason for that is very obvious. It's not actually to do with this dark band. The reason is really obvious when you look at the principal eigenvector overlaid onto this data. You can see in the white matter, you'd expect, and you can see the principal eigenvector is running along the white matter, so along the boundary there. In the grey matter, it's all perpendicular because all of the cells that are feeding down into the white matter are obviously perpendicular to the boundary. So as soon as you get partial voluming across this boundary, you get averaging. So as soon as you reduce the resolution of the data, you're averaging these things which actually have very perpendicular resolution. So you get very constructive interference between the eigenvectors here, which means that that will reduce the FA more than you might have expected. And that's why you're getting a tract thinning. So that needs to be kept in mind when interpreting changes, apparent changes in FA or tract thickness estimates. So I'm coming back to this question, finally, of disambiguating partial volume changes from FA changes. So even with our fantastic approach, if a tract is of similar size to voxels, there will still be partial voluming. It's not like you can go to the tract centre and claim that the centre was not partial volumed because the tract is sufficiently thin and the resolution in diffusion data is not very good. So is an apparent change in FA caused by a change in partial voluming across subjects, or a change in true FA? And that's hard to disambiguate, but we've done some initial work where we're trying to maybe disambiguate that. And again, we're using Jen McNabb's data in both full resolution and then simulating the low resolution from that to try and test some approaches here. So in F, what we have is the original high resolution ground truth mean diffusivity image derived from the tensor fitting. In blue here, we're seeing a white matter partial volume estimate. So we've actually fed the mean diffusivity into fast segmentation in FSL, taken the partial volume estimate from that, and then we've actually then downsampled that to give us the partial volume of white matter as if we had taken this at normal resolution data, so something like 4 millimeters data. This is the ground truth high resolution FA, and this is the high resolution FA skeletonized. So we're only going to concentrate on the skeleton boxes just to help help the interpretation, just to keep things simple. So then what we've done is we've fed the apparent normal resolution FA, which is what we see here after we've downsampled, and the normal resolution white matter partial volume estimate into a simple nonlinear model. So we've just done a quadratic or a cubic or a quartic and polynomial function of things which we can measure from at normal resolution. So the normal resolution partial volume estimate and the downsampled normal resolution skeletonized FA values. And then we just try and invert that polynomial to see if we can get back to the original high resolution FA, so the true underlying FA. So can we disambiguate the FA and the partial voluming? And it turns out that we can certainly get things a lot better by including these things together in a simple nonlinear model. But the problem with this is that we actually don't have access to a very good partial volume estimate, because in normal resolution data, for example, we can't use the mean diffusivity image to segment grey and white because it actually has terrible contrast in normal data. We can't trivially use structural data, although we might try to in future research, because for that to work, you would need absolutely perfect alignment between the structural data and the diffusion data. So that would need to be a very sophisticated approach. So we don't actually have access to the partial volume, but what we do potentially is we can use the tensor covariance, which is something we should really get CF to explain. This is something which CF and Gordon Kindleman have been developing up in Boston. And the tensor covariance is not what most people mean when they say higher order tensors, when they're just talking about higher order models within voxel. And the tensor covariance here is looking at the spatial covariance, so the neighborhood covariance of the basic diffusion tensor and how it covaries with the neighbors tensors. And it's quite easy to imagine that the covariance of how the estimated diffusion tensor covaries across neighbors has a lot of information about things like partial voluming. And so it turns out that if we put in all of the relevant parameters from the tensor covariance in instead of the partial voluming estimate, and that does even better and doesn't require the partial volume estimate. And so for example here, we've got the true FA versus the apparent FA, i.e. the downsampled FA. You've got quite a bias away from the y equals x line and quite a spread. And after feeding in the tensor covariance in the apparent FA, we can do a much better job of constructing the true underlying FA. So this is just initial results on trying to understand partial volume issues and disambiguating these in the data. This is the kind of thing you'd like to do at the end, for example, of a TBSS analysis to get better interpretation of what changes you're seeing. Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, thanks, Steve, for a really terrific talk. That's really a tremendous introduction to using TBSS and a lot of the issues involved. We certainly have time for a few questions if there are any. Christoph.
So I'm not entirely sure how you resolve the issue, the problem of correspondence that we have if you did a voxel-based analysis, because basically you project the FA values in the nearest skeleton. But that effectively is form of registration if you think about it. It's not even what you want.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The aim with this two-stage registration is not to solve the correspondence problem where there is no correspondence. The aim is to increase the accuracy of the nonlinear registration by explicitly searching for the track centres in a way that you could not expect to solve with that kind of accuracy with generic nonlinear registration, just by increasing the dimensionality or the fine detail of the warp field, because of this problem that if you have very, very high dimensional warping on data as poor quality as FA, you typically end up with it doing too much and becoming badly conditioned, and for example breaking topology, so for example splitting one tract or one junction up or merging tracts. And we've certainly seen that when we've tried to push the registration further, or even when we've run this kind of level of registration on poorer quality diffusion data. For example, you see the external capsule being pushed down into the internal capsule.
Okay, Michael has a question.
Do the skeletons make sense as you move closer to cortex?
Do you want to expand on that?
Well, I mean, one of the problems seems to be that we all want to push track into cortex, and everybody shows data showing how, as we move closer to cortex, you know, the ambiguity grows. So, and you're building skeletons from FA, fundamentally, right? From what you're doing it. So I'm just wondering, as I move out away from the core tracks, which are the large tracks, shouldn't I expect that? I have no reason to believe this. I've never done this myself, but I just think it might happen. that, the skeletons always start to look very chaotic, like false alarms, random crossings of a. So is that true?
Right.
So I'm going to say they're sort of not well, for the same reason that turning tracks up into cortex, is hard still for us. The skeleton should be less well defined because FA is not so strong. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's all true, and that's very much, I think, the point I was making on this slide, where the major reason that we threshold the mean FA skeleton is to eliminate exactly those more peripheral tracks regions where we do not get good correspondence across subjects. And so you would hope that as the quality of diffusion imaging improves in terms of resolution and SNR, we can afford to push this out further because we'll be able to push the registration a little bit further and get increasingly smaller tracks, more peripheral tracks aligned. But at this point, the thresholding is primarily there simply to avoid those dangers.
Right, so if that's true, then it would imply that the skeletons are reliable in the places where the large tracks are sort of reliable. There's sort of a couple. So
you pull
the threshold down because you don't want to show us all the false alarms.
Yeah.
So using the skeleton as one way to figure out where to pull, you're using that. You're using voxel-based statistics. You're doing voxel statistics.
Yeah.
It's just telling you where to pull, what door to knock on. There would be other ways, many other ways, or could be, that are stable as well for determining where to do voxel statistics if we're working predominantly in the places where the FA is strong and the white matter tracks are more common. So, there could be other ways of doing it as well. Take a Mori atlas and push it into, only look at the very strong track location, push it into the target, and you would expect that you'd get fairly good, polling regions as well.
Sure.
That's
right.
You think to counter, you're not arguing against it.
No.
But that's the right way for you to think about it, right?
Sure, yeah, you could do that, but you'd still potentially even, if you're then comparing the center of the posterior part of the corpus callosum, you still want to make sure that you are comparing like with like. And for example, if you compare, like in that terrible example I showed, if you've done what you suggested and you're comparing it right at the edge, you want to make sure that you've got the same track widths.
That's right. So you're more conservative in your polling region and maybe
sure.
You end up at your skeleton.
Yeah.
Or